there. Before you start listening, please make sure to subscribe to this podcast. This episode contains language and content of an explicit nature. Listener discretion is advised. Before a song is released, a record is produced, or a chorus is written, the musicians that write them think a lot. They live a lot, and they feel a lot. Before the chorus dives into the stories and experiences that shape these artists, and ultimately, the music we hear. I'm your host, Sophia Lopercaro, and this episode's guest is Griff.
To me, like, all of these songs are kind of from the voice of someone who just, like, you can't get it right, but is so desperate to love and so desperate to feel loved, and is trying to figure out that process. And whether that is romantically or just, you know, platonically.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Before the Chorus. As always, it is me, your host, Sophia Lopercaro. I was trying to think about what to talk to you guys about this week. I feel like I've been doing a lot of the usual stuff that I do, so I've just been kind of digging through, I guess, what I've been thinking about in the music world. And what I've been thinking about is the power of pop music. Okay, that's a very general sentence. Let me explain. I've realized that there are certain songs that just have to be done as pop songs. That's just the best way to do them. And that all comes down to the power of pop. I think I first started thinking about this a year ago when I found out through a previous guest of the podcast DMing me and telling me that Torn by Natalie Imbruglia is actually a cover. The original song was, it was written in 1991 by Scott Cutler and Ann Previn, and they released a version of the song with their band Edna Swap in 1995. I went back and listened to this version, and it's kind of like a stripped-down indie song. And it's good, but in my opinion, it works best in Natalie Imbruglia's version. And here's why. When you get to that chorus on the song, it's a song about, you know, realizing that someone is not the person that you thought they were, and feeling, as the song title suggests, really torn about it, and trying to grapple with the fact that you now have to reconcile the person that's in front of you versus the person that you thought they were. And when that chorus comes in, it is this big burst of emotion. And it only works because on the Natalie Imbruglia version, there's this big explosive arrangement around it. And it's just like one of those moments in pop music that is so iconic for, I mean, it's iconic, end of sentence, but I think it's so iconic because of how cathartic it is. Like, if you think about it, right, I'm not going to sing it, even though I'm very tempted to because it always gets stuck in my head. But, like, on that pre-chorus, it starts to, like, build and build and build, and then we have that big explosive feeling. And, again, this is, I know I'm getting really into the weeds of nerdy details here, but I think all this to say is that when we are processing big emotions, I think there's something about the format of pop that can really help us do that. Maybe because of its grandeur and its size and that, you know, it lets itself be so big and saturated. But also, a lot of the times, pop music is the genre that just says the thing plain and simple. There's no metaphors, there's no getting into the weeds. And by the way, I've said it many times, I am a big fan of very poetic and metaphor-filled songwriting. I've got Fleet Foxes tattoos on me, so, like, I'm not saying there isn't an absolutely wonderful and necessary place for that music. But I think for certain things, the sort of no-holds-barred transparency of a really good pop song, a really well-written pop song, is like the most potent thing that you can reach for. Now, of course, there is some pop music that's written as these sort of like throwaway vapid songs, but a really good pop song about a really big emotion is absolutely magic. And I think this is a perfect place to talk about this week's guest, Griff, because she did exactly this on her latest EP, Vertigo Volume 2. It is the follow-up to Vertigo Volume 1. And both parts of Vertigo track the varying, I guess, parts of processing a breakup. And that breakup can be romantic, it can be a friend breakup, it can be, you know, a loss of self through a job change, or just basically anything ending and having to reconcile with it, especially when you are someone who feels things with very big, saturated emotions. And I remember listening to both volumes of Vertigo when I was preparing for this interview and just being so blown away by Griff's ability to write, again, a really potent pop song. She can fit so much emotion into just a couple of words, and it's so impressive. And just like Torn by Natalie Imbruglia, it is so unbelievably cathartic. So I'm excited for you to hear this conversation between me and her. I'm going to leave you to it now. This is my conversation with Griff. I've been listening through Volume 1 and Volume 2 a lot, and like, I'm genuinely just like so amazed with your songwriting and your production. Like, it's so rich and nuanced, and like, my favorite pop music is pop music that can hold a lot of nuance in it, and you do that really beautifully. So
that's such a compliment. Thank you.
You're very really welcome.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, I don't say things that I don't mean. So yeah, I will say, I mean, we're mainly focusing on Volume 2 today, but I think it's important.
We can talk about it all.
Exactly. I think it's important that we talk about Volume 1 a little bit, because it sort of sets the stage of where things are starting, and then we can kind of get to where things are going, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. I feel like in terms of, like, I guess if you're talking about, like, the stages of a breakup, in terms of, like, the story within the two parts of Vertigo that are out so far, Volume 1 feels more like it's like the initial shock. Like, it's very raw and very kind of like trying to pick up pieces. Is that like a fair thing to say about it?
I don't know if I've ever consciously thought about it like that, but that's really accurate hearing you say that, for sure. Yeah.
Because, like, I love, like, watching, like, the kind of narrative arcs of things. And I was trying to figure out, like, what are, like, the kind of key differences between Volume 1 and Volume 2. And I feel like that's kind of really what it is. It's kind of like you still haven't quite begun to process something. And I mean, like, it's called Vertigo. And I think Vertigo is such a, you know, it's a disorienting feeling. So yeah. I think it's so apt.
You've nailed it. Yeah, for me, like, thematically, I think you're right. I think there is like a chronology of heartbreak going on between Volume 1 and Volume 2. And also, I think by Volume 2, it's almost like, yeah, it's almost like you're the deepest sorrow is, it's not subsided, but there's just that sonically there's an energy step up. And I guess there's like a sense of upliftingness, I think, in the sonic of Volume 2 to me.
I totally agree. I actually wrote that in my notes and was planning on asking you about that. I think it's funny because I feel like Volume 2, the lyrics are more somber, and yet the sound of it is way more upbeat. Like, all of the songs are much more up-tempo on average than Volume 1.
Definitely. Yeah. And that was intentional, I think. I don't know, with Volume 1, it was like, it'd been a while since I'd released music, and I think it would have been really easy to come with the big pop song to start. And I almost wanted to do the opposite of that and almost just like set the scene. And also I find like the big commercial ones that everyone's like, that's the single, is often not the ones that the fans love. And so I kind of wanted to come back and like set the scene and reconnect with fans, because I've been on tour for so long and been in other people's world, and I kind of just wanted to like step back into my world in like the most authentic way possible. And then it kind of felt right to start this year with Volume 2 and start with Miss Me Too, because that is a bit more like in your face and it's grander and more energetic. So yeah, that was kind of the thought process.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I do love that even on these more energetic songs, again, there's still a lot of nuance and a lot of like interesting topics. It doesn't feel like your kind of average clear-cut breakup song. Like, there's a lot more going on there. Going back to Volume 1 for a minute, I think I really appreciate it, maybe because I'm a late millennial, and I think that the issues that, in terms of like the types of things that you're talking about experiencing on this record, in terms of like heartbreak and dating and all that, I think are very common to the experience of a lot of people who are either late millennials or Gen Z. This sort of like non-committal, half in, half out, like only giving you like breadcrumbs, sort of just to kind of keep you around. And I mean, I've said it on this podcast before, I'm dating in the LA scene, so
God bless you.
Yeah. So there's a lot of lines across both volumes that I was like, ow.
Yeah. Sip tea and just sit in that for a sec. Yeah.
I'm going to go stare at a wall for an hour.
Literally. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I think you're right. I think to me, like all of these songs are kind of from the voice of someone who just like, you can't get it right, but is so desperate to love and so desperate to feel loved, and is trying to figure out that process, and whether that is romantically or just, you know, platonically or with family, or, you know, I think I write from a lot of different places and not just romantically. But yeah, I think it's all from this kind of place of like, I'm here and I really want to, yeah, almost dive in, and I can't figure out where I'm going wrong in all of that, you know?
Yeah. I definitely can relate to that. I think, I don't want to go into like the super like Instagrammy thing of talking about like attachment styles and all that shit, but and again, this is maybe just knowing myself, and so hopefully I'm not projecting, but I get the sense that you are a deeply feeling person based on the way that you write.
I think so. I think that's pretty safe to say for most creatives, and especially songwriters. And I think also like deeply feeling, but also like very, very observant, and very trying to be very self-aware, and probably too overthinking, I think is probably like common traits for all songwriters. I think it's probably how we write songs. And I also feel like the best heartbreak songs, or just pop songs in general, the ones that can like encapsulate a universal feeling but like feel like it's coming at it in a new way. And I think you do have to be quite like really highly observant to find a new angle and a new perspective on universal feelings. So yeah, I'd say that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Fair. And I think I also see that in the sense that, like, you know, I think certain people who are deeply feeling and are willing to kind of open themselves up to connection, whether that be, like you said, romantic or family or friendship, you know, it can feel like, you know, you're willing to be vulnerable and give yourself to human connection. And it's hard when you meet someone who's not willing to meet you at that level, but maybe still feels good being around you. So they give you kind of just enough to keep you. And I think that's, again, where this record really hit close to home for me.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, yeah, exactly. And it's like the perspective of someone who's like deeply loyal, but also I guess like is slightly confused in my own understanding of what love is. And it's like deeply reflective in that sense as well. I feel like we all hit that kind of coming out of adolescent stage where you're like, wait, do I even have a healthy understanding of relationships and love and how all of these dynamics are supposed to happen? And, you know, how much is my upbringing and all of my other experiences impacted this? And am I reacting right? And am I not? So it's all of those kind of introspective feelings, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's hard for any of us. You know, we grew up in a world that like tells us, you know, love is supposed to look a certain way, or connection is supposed to look a certain way. It's shoved down our throats from the day that we're born. And there's such a chasm of disconnect between, you know, what we're told versus what's real. And yeah, so it's I think it's a totally normal thing. And I think this is a good place to jump over to volume two, because I think volume two is a lot more existential than volume one.
Yeah, I like that. I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I think this is where a lot of those questions are really starting to bubble up to the surface.
Yeah, exactly. I think like, to me, it's almost like you're like comfortably, not comfortably, comfortably, but like you've wallowed in this state of heartache for a while now, and it's like just reflecting on that. It's like Pillow in My Arms is, it's and Hole in My Pocket. They're both songs about like complete loss and loneliness to me, where it's like with Pillow in My Arms, it's like about your only companion left being your pillow, because, and you know, it's like your pillows would have heard all of the nights we've cried. It's heard all of the times you've tried to rehearse all the things you wish you said to that person. It's like been there when you're dancing to your favorite song in your room. Like, so it's that picture to me. And similarly with Hole in My Pocket, it's like a song about trying to figure out why you're losing things at such a rapid rate, whether it's like the most trivial, stupid things like something in your bag, or whether it's like all of these relationships in your life. So, yeah.
It's interesting that you say that about Hole in My Pocket, because it's, I mean, it's definitely the one that's kind of looking the most inward at one's own role in relationships, of like, again, mm-hmm. what am I doing versus what is that other person doing, you know?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Well, I also do like to write songs that are more about, I'm more me focused because I'm just obsessed with myself. No, but I think there's so much figuring out you try and do with other people. And even with Miss Me Too, I love that one because it's not really about another person. It's kind of all about trying to find yourself and trying to figure out yourself and where you're at and all of that pain. So yeah, I think those ones are almost the funnest to write because you can really dig deep with those ones, you know?
Absolutely. I was curious about Miss Me Too. Is it more about, you know, missing who you were in the context of, again, whether it be a romantic or platonic connection, or is it more about missing who you were before that happened, or both?
I think it's a sense of both. I think it's like, I'm not even sure if the voice almost is sure of that. All you're certain of, I think, in that song is that you're like completely hollow and you completely don't recognize where you're at, and it's just like trying to retrace all of those steps and like how you've ended up at this point, and it's trying to like, yeah, go over like, wait, there was a plan in that, and I thought this was supposed to work out, and I thought this was supposed to work out, and it didn't. And it's like, it's kind of a song about at the end of when the plan doesn't, like the lyric, like I drank the drinks and I shook the hands and I believed the plan. It's like you were almost so naive and stupid enough to believe in the best of the plan, and it didn't go right, and you're going, now I've lost myself in it, and I don't know how to get that back, you know?
Totally, yeah. And I think we all deserve to be kinder to ourselves than to feel like we're stupid for it. I think, you know, I've learned in my own experience, we're doing the best that we can with the information that we have. And and when something ends, you know, it's so normal that it kind of like obliterates your sense of self for a little while.
Yeah, it's true. And you kind of sit there for a while and you try and figure it out and piece it back together, I guess. Yeah.
Totally. It feels like the kind of existential parts of Volume 2 both deal with that, like, who am I piece of existentialism, but as well as, like, what is, you know, is connection worth it? Is, you know, like you said, how is it supposed to look? And it's kind of in, I guess, through the lens of, you know, something happening or something ending, which I think is super normal. Is that like a fair assessment, you would say, of a lot of that, or?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, and I think, I'd say it's pretty accurate. And yeah, like I said, I drew inspiration from a lot of different relationships in my life. And I think even like with Miss Me Too, like there was just a real feeling and a real shift in my life where it was like, we'd all come out of a pandemic. I'd been thrown on the road for like a year or two. I moved out of home this year. Like, I feel like there's a common experience that we've all shared in the last few years where there is a big gear shift and things ending and things starting. And I guess that's kind of the perspective of all of that. So, yeah.
I never thought about it through the lens of the pandemic, but that's so interesting. Do you think there's any like key things that you've like gained from either going into the pandemic or coming out of it, like about yourself? It's a big question, definitely. But we're going for
it. No, it's true. Yes, I definitely learned. What did I learn? I mean, it was a really intense time, and I don't think, I think we all just carried on and didn't kind of try to catastrophize. Well, some of us did, but I definitely tried not to catastrophize it too much and like just keep going and keep releasing songs. But I think in hindsight, I realized how much I like being alone and I need time to write and I need time to be in those thoughts. And I think I found it really hard once the world had opened up and everything had kind of accelerated for me to kind of find my feet and all of that. And suddenly the songwriting process was completely taken from me, which is fine in the nature of the job. It's just something no one ever prepares you for. And I couldn't write on the road and all that kind of stuff. And so I definitely learned a lot about myself in that sense. And I think in the whole process of trying to write a body of work in that, I think I realized how much I relied on everyone else's approval and opinions when it came to all of my work and my songs. And so suddenly, like as soon as I didn't feel that from like a team member or whatever, it honestly was like pretty world shattering because, yeah, I was fortunate enough to write a lot of songs in my when I was in school, and they kind of came out and everyone loved it. And it's kind of that like honeymoon phase of like being with the label and all of that kind of stuff. And then suddenly I realized that I really needed to figure out what it was I wanted to say and like my own opinion about my work. So yeah, I went through that whole journey for sure.
Yeah. I almost wonder if Miss Me Too almost holds a little bit of that, whether that be consciously or subconsciously.
I think so. Yeah, I think definitely subconsciously all of my experiences will be like littered throughout all the lyrics for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Ugh, I love that. This is why I love like talking about this stuff and like finding all the ways that like the back end of our brain creeps into
Yeah,
art.
I know. It
It's
is amazing. I think that's why I love, it's why I get such a kick out of songwriting and why it's my first love, because it's like you're totally, it does, it's cheesy, but it does feel like magic because you won't have an idea now and in 2 hours you'll have a whole song and it will all be like the cogs of your brain in the back end of your brain working and feeding into it, and you'll listen to a song in 2 hours that didn't exist before and you go, oh, that's how where I was at, and that's kind of where it all kind of just poured out. And it still is like a really electric feeling. Yeah.
Totally. And I love like when sometimes it seems like these like seemingly disparate parts of your brain all kind of randomly fall into place and create this one beautiful thing. Like this one experience or this one conversation or this one like feeling all like weirdly end up together, and it's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's like a thing you can't ever, and there's no formula with it, which is the most frustrating thing. Because if there was, you could just do it over and over again. And sometimes you're just banging your head against the wall going, I've got nothing today. And then sometimes you're like, I've got loads today. And it's like the fun of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good that you call it the fun of it and not the pain in the ass of it, but
It's both. I think you feel so much more relieved when you get to the other end knowing that you've had to wrestle for it. Like I definitely found that with Vertigo, like I really had bad writer's block. And by the end of like that night that I wrote Vertigo, that honestly it was like the most feeling of relief that I could still write a song. And it was like almost even more of a high because I hadn't felt this that feeling in such a long time. So yeah.
yeah. Well, I mean, that one's well deserved. Like, even just that opening line, you're scared of heights, it's vertigo. Like, just, I mean, quite like the literal image of like being afraid of falling. And, but
Yeah.
also like everything else that's in it, it's just so good. It's so
Thank
good.
you.
It just
Thank
holds so
you.
much. And I love that.
Thank you so much.
You deserve it. Very random, but have you ever heard a song called I Was Neon by Julia Jacklin? Because I think you would really like it.
No, but I love Julia Jacklin. Does she have that song Swimming Pools? Or there is a song from Julia Jacklin that I really love, but I need to check it out. I'm going to write it down.
I mean, I've been listening a lot to another one of hers called Pressure to Party, which is another really good one.
Okay, I need to check her out a little more.
But yeah, but I think you'd really like it because it's not, I wouldn't say it's the same as Miss Me Too, but there is that sort of piece of like being afraid to lose yourself when you fall in love with a new person.
Yeah.
And being like her being like, I was neon, I was like this vibrant thing, and I don't want to become small when I fall in love with this next person, you know? I
That's
don't
so
wanna,
cool.
yeah.
Yeah, she's really cool. Yeah, it's Pool Party, the song that I love of hers.
Okay.
But
Yeah, I don't think I know that one.
Amazing. Okay. You check out one, I'll check out the other two.
Deal. We're going to do it. I think, what was I? You know what? There was something in volume one that I wanted to jump back to, and that was Into the Walls. There was something you said before, and I think it was kind of about like that needing to be alone and kind of needing to be able to step back. And I feel like I get a lot of that sort of energy from Into the Walls, and I was kind of curious if that's the case or like where your kind of head was at on that one.
Yeah, I think also what defines volume one for me is there's this sense of like it's the voice of an introvert, which I think is really clear in Into the Walls. And that one's like a real song about like absolute numbness and like being at such an emotional low that you're like jealous of the walls, because at least they can stand up and they're strong and they watch the world go by, and you know, that seems like a peaceful existence and something you can't say for yourself. And yeah, I actually wrote that one around the time of the Brit Awards. So it was like coming out of COVID. And so I think it was like such a drastic difference to what I was experiencing. Like my whole career had been accelerated very quickly. But yeah, those were kind of the lyrics that I guess I was feeling at the time. And that I often feel, I think Into the Walls is still a song that I will always listen to and feel like almost want to cry, because it's always very real for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a very opposite image too, like the kind of more disorienting and raw feelings on the rest of the record. Like you said, like it's literal stability, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I guess it was not, and it wasn't like an obvious song for me to put out either. I mean, it's quite like a folky song. It's like not like a big explosive pop melody or anything. But then it just kind of has that like, almost like treading rhythm to it, and it is kind of does have a dancey-ness to it, but it's very solemn in a way. But yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I love, like, I mean, for one, I think, you know, it kind of gives depth and flow to a record when you have some ups and downs, and I don't know. I love a surprise folk moment on a pop volume. I think they're great.
I think in my heart of hearts, one day I'm just going to write a full folk singer-songwriter album, because it's just like, it's the best. I mean, it's a very saturated thing, and it's probably not what's going to make loads of money or what anyone in my team or anyone wants to hear. But I think it's like my most comfortable pocket to be in, for sure.
I mean, Taylor Swift did it, so.
Exactly, exactly.
And she brought in Aaron Dessner of The National, like.
I know, it's mad. It's so true. Yeah.
So you could do it. There's a way. Yeah, also, yeah. I fully know of like a few pop artists that like people I know who like have like secret folk songs that they kind of just keep in their back pocket and they don't release. But
I know we all just love a little guitar folk moment.
We do.
And we need to stop hiding from it, I think. Yeah.
Totally. Or just kind of like find tiny ways to like let it bleed into to the pop if you want, which I think you do. Because like I said, I think that learning a lot about nuanced songwriting often comes from folk music. I think folk and rap are two of the genres that have some of the most nuanced writing. And so whenever I see them kind of like peek their way into pop music a little bit, I'm always so impressed.
You're right. I mean, it's weird, actually. I mean, I was trying to think more in like, yeah, like almost like a rap bar headspace when I was writing Vertigo and those lyrics, because they're like just these stupid couplets that rhyme with Vertigo. And so to me, I was more trying to think in that world than like, you're scared of heights, that's Vertigo, like almost what a rap would be. I don't know if that's like, I'm going to regret saying that, but.
No, I see the principle of it, totally.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but it works. Like even though they're couplets, they're very rich. Like I said, there's a lot of really strong imagery in them, and I think that's one of the things that rap does really well. It can say a lot with very few words.
100%, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
totally. I think, you know, I think one of the last places that I want to linger to is the last song on volume two, which is Cycles, because it feels like a little bit of a shift from the other three songs, like, you know, whereas I think the way that I read it, at least, and as I always do on this podcast, I'll be like, here's how I saw it, and if I'm totally wrong, you could tell me. I can still enjoy my interpretation, but the whole point of this is to like hear again what's really behind them. But the way that I read it is, you know, the first three songs feel like they're much more stuck in, like, the grieving and the existential kind of period, whereas Cycles is still grieving, but it's starting to become more self-aware and starting to be like, I'm in a cycle. Like, I need to maybe note that. Is that by design, and is that their reason that it's the last song on the volume?
Yes. Yeah, I'm just going through the lyrics in my head now. Yeah, it's definitely still in like that grieving headspace, but I think like sonically, obviously, it's super different, and that's because when we wrote it, it was like it felt dancey, and I wrote it in Sweden, and then I was like, you know, I want to send it to Muramasa, and so he produced the song, and I think he's got such like a clear DNA of like a Muramasa track, and I'm so happy that that's kind of in my in volume two, because I've never told him this, but he like was such a big influence for me when I was like 15 getting into songwriting. Like, I'd never really heard electronic music like that, where it was so melodic and so rhythmic, but like the plucks were so beautiful and stuff like that. So he definitely impacted my production a lot, style a lot. And so it was very cool that he said yes to producing it. But I think he really took it to that kind of existential euphoric state. Like, it has that whole kind of instrumental moment where it does feel like you're in a cycle and the vocals are going round. And so, yeah, I guess that probably explains maybe like the sonic difference behind all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But even like thematically, I was curious about the shift, and I'm wondering, both on a sonic level and on a lyrical level, is it something that like points to like where the next round of music is going, you would say, or is it just kind of its own standalone moment?
I don't know. It's hard to say, because I've heard these songs so much that I'm like, I think fresh ears would probably hear everything better. But I think it is a good pointer. I think Miss Me Too and Cycles are a good pointer for like what's coming next. What's coming next is it is that kind of bigger, euphoric energy feeling, and so yeah, I think it maybe is a good signal.
I like that. Oh, yeah. I love that. I love a record that kind of has that type of arc.
Yeah, I think that arc was important for me. It's like start at the moody and the low and the insular, and then arrive at somewhere that, even though it's still desperately heartbroken, there's a sense of like dance and freedom and confidence that's back, I think. Yeah.
Vertigo Volume 2 is available now wherever you normally get your music. This podcast is hosted, edited, and produced by myself, Sophia Lopercaro, and the artwork is by Meg Wilford.